in disabling elliptic curve cryptography, yes, you burn some coins, but you also allow many other people to retain ownership by doing proof of seed phrase, proof of BIP32 derivation. Like, if you can prove you know the seed phrase, you don't actually need EC. That's quantum secure. Look, I got my agent to do this thing and it's really amazing and it like wrote all this awesome code. Then you try it and it doesn't. What happened if we had a remote code execution vulnerability in Bitcoin Core where people could hack into your node remotely and steal your private keys? If all the private keys to all the wallets leaked, there's no recovery from that. Bitcoin has never had an opportunity like this. If AI agents start using Bitcoin or maybe using stablecoins, it owes taxes, but how?
All views expressed by the host or guests are solely their own opinions. Nothing stated in this podcast should be considered a specific endorsement to make any particular investment or follow any specific strategy.
Welcome to All in Bitcoin, Matt.
Yeah.
Today, we'll find out exactly what's at stake when AI starts using money.
Okay.
But first, let's get to know you a little bit better. Ready?
Sure.
You've been working on Bitcoin for 15 years. What kept you here this long?
Oof, good question. I feel like there's always more to do. So, you know, we keep making... It's interesting because 15 years ago, I never would have imagined that we got this far, right? That Bitcoin is a topic in international politics and international relations and national politics in the US. But at the same time, every time we make one step forward, there's always just feels like so many different things that we still need to do to really get the user experience we want or the you know, whatever properties we want. And so it just makes it feel like my work is never done.
So what pulled you into it?
So... Yeah, I got into Bitcoin in 2011. I saw a podcast at the time that did an hour and a half long deep dive on explaining how Bitcoin worked in 2011. It was a podcast I watch regularly anyway.
Which one?
It was a podcast by the name of Security Now. It's in the Twit network. I have no idea if it's still going. I haven't watched it in a long time. But yeah, in 2011, they did an hour and change long deep dive explaining Bitcoin. And I just found it really interesting that there's this digital money, like online money. You know, I spent a lot of time online, like many teenagers, and was just found this fascinating that we could have this online value system where we could transfer between each other and no one else was involved. And it was just entirely within the nodes of the network. And that we could build such a thing was fascinating. And so I just kind of kept looking more into it and more into it. And we ended up, you know, I ended up working on it and contributing to it. And it all kind of snowballed from there.
How old were you at the time?
18-ish or 19 or 17 or something like that. I was interested in computers. I knew some of how to program. I didn't know much about C or C++. I didn't really know what a pointer was. but I knew some of how to program. I spent a lot of time online, and I was very interested in computers. So I found this thing fascinating and ended up learning to code more on Bitcoin as time went on.
Do you question Bitcoin sometimes?
At high level, yes. Like, yes, I question, you know, are we succeeding in our goals? Is there something that'll go wrong? I mean, I've spent however long, 15 years and change in Bitcoin. Most of that time has been worried about this going wrong or that going wrong. I'm somewhat infamous for always assigning a low probability chance that I think Bitcoin will succeed. and the goalposts always shift, and my view of what success means and where Bitcoin should get to always changes. But I always kind of, my job is to worry about all the things that could go wrong. And so, yes, I'm always worried about all the things that could go wrong, rather than to just be very bullish and only talk about the things that could go right.
So right now, what are your worries?
My concerns for the last 10 years or something has been mining decentralization and ability of self-custody to be good user experience. Like, can we build a good user experience around self-custody so that people choose to self-custody instead of using a trusted intermediary? And so those have been kind of the biggest things I've worried about. Obviously, there's plenty of other things to worry about and to think on and work through. You know, can we upgrade to post-quantum signatures in time? And then what will Bitcoin do when a quantum computer eventually exists? You know, I don't think it's happening soon, but like at some point, maybe it will. And like, what should we be doing now? What concerns will we have then? There's always a million things that could go wrong with Bitcoin that I'm worried about. But
one of mine is Bitcoin centralization in the hands of institutions. What do you think about that?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's a big concern too. Absolutely. Not only single institutions that hold a lot of Bitcoin and might have power over Bitcoin, but also that all the ETFs use Coinbase, the same custodian. So there's one pot of money, there's one wallet system that stores, you know, obviously they have different keys, but you know, one wallet system that stores all that Bitcoin. You know, what happens if they get hacked? That was, you know, a big concern in going back to 2011. Something I always worried about is, you know, everyone used the Bitcoin Core wallet. There was no other wallet. It was just the Bitcoin client. It wasn't even called Bitcoin Core, right? And at the time, a lot of these people were mining all the time and were leaving their nodes on all the time. What happened if we had a remote code execution vulnerability in Bitcoin Core where people could hack into your node remotely and steal your private keys? If all the private keys to all the wallets leaked, there's no recovery from that. And so you could imagine similar situations with like if Coinbase, you know, I'm sure I know some of the folks who work at Coinbase, but like I know they did a really great job with their custody setup. But what happens if, you know, everyone involved gets kidnapped, like the entire board of Coinbase and all of the security officers all get kidnapped, or their wives or kids get kidnapped? What is the worst case scenario here? And does that impact Bitcoin? I think that's a definitely a very material concern.
What's a signal you ignore but shouldn't?
Because I spend all my time worried about the ways Bitcoin could go wrong, I have gotten very good at ignoring that intuition. My intuition is always that it's going to go wrong, which is the wrong intuition, but I've gotten good at ignoring that intuition because I spend all my time worried about that. And so I think finding the right balance of that signal is always hard for me.
Do you trust your instincts more than your reasoning?
I think sometimes. I think I mentioned earlier that, like, you know, a lot of my instinct is always to and this has been my job for the last 15 years, but to worry about ways Bitcoin can go wrong. And so that builds a certain instinct that I have to suppress sometimes. But I think in general, I balance the two fairly well. And more often than not, my reasoning will match my instinct. Not always. And there's actually interesting behavioral studies on this where some of the smartest people will have some of the most irrational positions because they're better at coming up with arguments to support the position they want to get to than someone who's maybe not as smart. And so it's very easy for someone to come up with arguments that support their position. And so you have to be a little careful because, you know, in saying that my reasoning often matches my instinct, I might also just be saying that I come up with arguments to support my instinct.
Yeah.
But I think I try not to do that too much, but it's maybe that's what I'm saying. I'm not sure.
What's something about Lightning that still frustrates you today?
Oh, what doesn't frustrate me? yeah, I mean, I think the story of my involvement with Lightning for the last 5-6 years has been really one of how do we make self-custody the thing that people want to use with Lightning, and how do we make that accessible to many wallets, right? So like, I think Phoenix is great, like they do a really good job, but you know, they're one wallet, and like other wallets don't use similar models, and other wallets there's not competition around LSP pricing and fee pricing because, you know, they built their kind of vertically integrated stack. But how do we build a software suite that enables everyone to do that kind of wallet, but also then better, like fix all the warts that Lightning has and that Phoenix has also fixed over the years? You know, we've been doing some of the same work that they have been, but enabling that and making it broadly available so that self-custody Lightning is a default, because you know, the history of Lightning is moved towards like custodial Lightning. Everyone's doing custodians because people wrote off Lightning as too hard to do on a mobile phone or in a self-custodial wallet. And I don't think that's true, but that certainly was true. You know, that like LND is not designed to run on phones. It doesn't run well on phones. It makes your phone hot. And people early using LDK suffered lots of issues and UX warts and whatever. And so I don't think it's true anymore, but it is still really hard to do self-custodial Lightning and no one, people don't do it. And so people default to custodial. And I think that's really frustrating.
Mm-hmm. The hardest no you've ever had to say?
Oh, nothing really comes to mind that's super compelling, but like, I know, you know, when I left Chaincode, they wanted to figure out how to keep me around, and at the time I was starting to date my now wife remotely, and I needed that remote job, so that was hard to leave there because the Chaincode environment's so great and the founders are great and the environment's great, but also I needed a job that let me be remote so I could date my now wife. Looking back, that was the right decision, but it was hard.
Why do you think Satoshi didn't burn his coins?
Ooh, yeah, that's another really good question. I don't know. My assumption is that Satoshi mined the coins, didn't think they were necessarily going to spend them, and then either like lost the hard drive or passed away or just for whatever reason didn't have access to those coins anymore. And, you know, in 2010, 2011, 2012, 2013, it maybe didn't matter very much. And then now, however, 15, 20 years later, it does matter more, but now they no longer can, would be my assumption.
What do you think about Jameson Lopp's idea that if they are not touched in 5 years, burn them? Are you familiar with it?
Yeah, they have this BIP361, I think, is their proposal to disable EC and burn old coins.
361?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
I don't think it makes sense to do it based on time. I don't see any reason for that. I think I firmly believe that there's no reason to think that the progress of quantum computers will shift to private, that like the US government's going to come in and acquire all these quantum labs and forcibly acquire and pay, you know, billions and billions and billions of dollars to do so just to keep it secret. And then they're going to go steal the Bitcoin or something. I don't think is realistic. Instead, I think that the progress will continue in public. We'll all see the progress. We'll all be relatively aware of it. And there'll be the Bitcoin community will all have somewhat the same view of where quantum is once it gets close. Obviously, today, some people think it's never going to happen. Some people think it's 2 years away. But like, you know, when it's 6 months away, I think we'll all roughly agree that it's somewhere between 6 and 9 months away. And so to get back to your question, because of that, I don't see a reason for the Bitcoin community to materially entertain freezing coins before that point. That once we're at that point and everyone kind of agrees that like it's now or never, then that's when that conversation has to happen and that decision has to be made. But until then, I don't see any reason to engage with it. And as to whether or not Bitcoin should freeze the coins at that point or not, you know, I think it's decided by the market. Like there will be a fork and there will be two sides to the fork and the market's going to have to pick which one has more value. But I personally think that the market will probably pick the side that burns the coins, because I think it's also a long ways away. That like by that point, everyone has had a chance to migrate, and in disabling elliptic curve cryptography, yes, you burn some coins, but you also allow many other people to retain ownership by doing proof of seed phrase, proof of BIP32 derivation. Like if you can prove you know the seed phrase, you don't actually need EC. That's quantum secure. A seed phrase derivation from a seed phrase to public key is quantum secure. And so you can prove you know the seed phrase and you could use that to spend the coins. But it's a package deal, right? You either enable people to prove they know the seed phrase or BIP32 for derivation or pre-commit. There's a few things you would do to allow people to retain ownership. And then you also burn some other coins. Anyone who doesn't have these things or do these things would get their coins burned. Or you do none of that. And then everyone gets their coins stolen, right? And so it's binary. You have to pick one. Either everyone gets their coins stolen or some people retain their coins and some people get burned. And I think that the Bitcoin community will choose option A and burn some coins, but some people get to retain their coins, because I think it'll be a long ways away. And at that point, people will have had so long to upgrade that the number of coins that will be lost in the burn will be minuscule. And the number of coins that are retained in enabling people with seed phrases or whatever to reclaim their funds would be, you know, also not huge, but much larger. Much larger.
This episode is brought to you by Bitbox, the Swiss-built Bitcoin hardware wallet that guards your sovereignty. I use Bitbox because it's fully open source, easy to use, and I can plug it into my phone. If you need a hardware wallet to keep your Bitcoin off exchanges, offline, and safe, go to bitbox.swiss/allinbitcoin for 5% off, or use the code allinbitcoin, or check the show notes. Join me at BTC Hell 2026, the Nordic Bitcoin Conference in Helsinki this September 25th, 26th. Use code allinbitcoin for 10% off your ticket. See you there. Guys, I've got a quick favor to ask. If you are listening right now, take a second and hit subscribe and the bell if you are on YouTube, or follow on your podcast app so you don't miss the episodes and guests that matter to you. If we've ever given you value, this is the moment to give it back. It's free, it takes 2 seconds, and it genuinely helps keep improving every single episode. And to everyone already following, thank you. You are the reason we've been able to raise the bar. Your support, whether it's a donation, a comment, or subscribing, helps these conversations reach further. It also gives us the push to keep going, keep traveling, keep preparing, and keep bringing you in-person conversations like this. Thank you. Who or what do you watch closely these days?
There's not a lot I watch super closely in terms of Bitcoin stuff. You know, I try to keep up on the news, and my screen time on news apps tends to be an hour a day or more. So I do try to keep up with many perspectives on what happens in the world. So I guess that's probably my answer. But, you know, on the Bitcoin side, it's mostly I just don't have the time to keep up with almost anything. You know, I don't have the time to read the mailing list or delving or anything. So it's hard, aside from what people send to me.
What's something most people misunderstand about you?
Well, these days, the most obvious one is that people assume a lot about my politics. Personally, my biggest view in politics that I've come around to is that I wish we were still in a world where politics wasn't people's identity, and that that people got along without needing to know or care about each other's politics, and that politics was something you left in the voting booth and not weren't super public about. But these days, mostly due to various conspiracy theories about people's assumption about Bitcoin Core's politics, which, I mean, I don't even contribute to Bitcoin Core anymore, but whatever, people have assumed a certain political lean of me, and also assume as much because my Twitter profile or my ex profile has blue hair in it, which I did at one point have blue hair, but this was before it had political connotations. And at this point, I just leave the blue hair in my profile picture because it filters out everyone I don't want to talk to. If your response is to make a comment about my blue hair in my profile picture, I probably didn't want to talk to you to begin with. So I leave that as my profile photo.
How do you stay grounded when the number goes up?
That's a good question. I think that when the number goes up, I generally don't look very much at the number. You know, obviously, been in Bitcoin for a while. Bitcoin's a very material portion of my net worth. So it does, you know, it makes an impact, and I have to reason about it. But usually, between my wife and I, at the start of any bull market, we sit down and have a conversation about where we think the price is realistically going to go and set a plan for whether we sell at which price and how much we sell, if we sell at all, and whatever, and you know, what we might want, you know, if we're going to go buy a house or whatever. And then we set that and we stick to it, and then we don't look at it. So I think that's always the best way to do it, is to sit there honestly at the start of a bull market and say, you know, is there something I need? Do I want to buy a house? And like, if Bitcoin reaches this amount, would I go buy a house? Would I go buy a car? Would I go whatever? Would I go buy, you know, Tesla stock? I don't know. But set the plan at the start and then don't look at it. Don't think about it. And if you hit the target number that you wanted, and then go buy your house. And if not, oh, well. So I think that's worked well for me. And
that's very sane.
I think that more people would do well to do that.
On that point, do you think we are in a bear market or a bull market right now?
I think the four-year cycle is over. Subscribe to that.
Okay.
Maybe there'll be perturbations around the next four-year cycle or whatever, but it really does seem like, and I mean, that was natural, right? Like the amount of Bitcoin, the amount of reduction in Bitcoin supply from the miners halves every four-year cycle. And Bitcoin goes up in price, but Bitcoin also just becomes a much larger economy. And so, you know, you start to need a lot more inflows in dollar terms in order to make large price gaps, large price differences as the Bitcoin halving continues. And so, you know, at some point it wasn't going to make as large an impact. And I think we're starting to reach that point where it's just not making as large an impact. So I don't tend to think in like bear bull cycles anymore. I don't know that we're going to hit $130,000 again in the like very near term, but are we going to like wander down, the price wander down for the next 3 years, like the last few cycles? Hopefully not, but I think probably also not as much this cycle anymore.
What's one thing every Bitcoiner should stop doing?
Bringing politics into it. Again, I tend to miss the, well, I mean, I wasn't as much alive during that world, but I tend to think that the world would be better off if people left their politics in the voting booth. And it's true that Bitcoin is a political system in a sense. But it's interesting, you know, we're here in Europe and talking to a lot of Europeans view the politics of Bitcoin very differently. Right, it's not as libertarian. It's more freedom of you know, you having money that is yours, that is free, rather than like ending the Fed. Like the Fed is evil, and we should abolish the Fed, which you see a lot more in the U.S. community. And so, I think this very polarization and politicization of Bitcoin is really negative for Bitcoin in the long term. And so, I wish more Bitcoiners would support Bitcoin without making their support of Bitcoin something which is political in nature, and rather just support Bitcoin. And then, you know, they can have their politics separately and also be political, but not necessarily tie the two together as much.
What do you think is negative?
I think that, I mean, certainly in the US, we've seen already a very immediate result that fewer Democrats are willing to go out and support Bitcoin-friendly policies. We've already seen that materially, and you know, in the past that wasn't true. Like Bitcoin was fairly bipartisan. We saw both Democrats and Republicans support Bitcoin-friendly policies, or you know, both of them also supported anti-Bitcoin policies. But with Bitcoin being very, very tied to the Republican results as of the last election, and you know, Trump going to the Bitcoin conference and whatever, it's been politically harder for Democrats to support Bitcoin, and I think as a result, that really hurts our ability to get policy through and not have the government try to ban Bitcoin or try to ban privacy services on Bitcoin or ban LSPs or ban whatever that really is an important part of making Bitcoin work.
The Biden administration wasn't very into Bitcoin, right?
Yeah, the Biden administration was very hostile to crypto and Bitcoin, but so was the first Trump administration. You know, the first Trump administration was arguably worse. And it's the Biden administration was very anti-crypto, a little less anti-Bitcoin, but they were still definitely anti-Bitcoin. They just didn't spend as much effort trying to destroy Bitcoin. They spent a lot of effort trying to destroy crypto. But the first Trump administration also tried to destroy Bitcoin. So I think it was equally bipartisan in their dislike of it, but some congressional and Senate folks did like Bitcoin. But now it's just one side of the aisle, and I think that's probably worse.
What part of your work weighs on you the most?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, I spend a lot of time worrying about different ways Bitcoin can go wrong and different risks and long-term risks. And so I think there's always a part of me that's feels like, you know, these large risks I'm really worried about, like, for example, mining centralizations. Like, I don't actually spend much of my time on it because I focus on other risks that I think are also important and not necessarily more important, but just harder, unless I spend my resources on those. You know, it's always frustrating to me that the Bitcoin community and the Bitcoin developer community and the Bitcoin developer funding community doesn't spend more time trying to address these risks. And there are many people who do, but there's many more people who only talk about the positives of Bitcoin and don't think about the negatives, the risks, and then also don't do anything about it. So, you know, you look at like P2Pool V2, I think is a really cool project and addresses a complementary set of miners from Stratum V2 and might enable some material mining decentralization wins in some part of the mining market. And I don't really get the sense that people know what P2Pool V2 is, think about it, or talking about it. And it's like, you know, P2Pool V2 plus Stratum V2 are two of the most important projects in Bitcoin. And like, people don't talk about them. Or in many cases, aren't even aware of them. And I think that's...
Who do we need to interview to talk about them?
So Jungly is actually here, one of the P2Pool V2 developers, who's great. I love Jungly.
Okay. What's your favorite movie and book?
Oh, man. I just don't spend a lot of time consuming much content anymore, which is my loss. I should read more. I don't read all that much. But yeah, if I had to pick one, it's...
Or a movie.
You know, there's some great movies out there. It was a summer in college where I didn't have an internship, wasn't doing anything. So I was back at home with my parents and just like basically spent my time watching my way through the IMDb top 100 list and just watched, I don't know, probably 50 movies that summer or something. So, you know, there's some classics. There's like The Shawshank or something. You know, it was classic, but I always love the old character studies, the just, you know, slow moving films that really get you to know someone on screen and study how they react to different situations. I always love movies like that.
Mm. What's an AI agent and why does everyone seems to have one much better than mine?
It's a good point. So, I mean, AI agents are really just taking these models and these models get retrained to make tool calls, right? So a model can output text that says, actually call this command or go to this website or whatever. And so now that they can do these tool calls, you can say, chat with an AI, or chat with an LLM, and it will then go do things on your behalf. So potentially, you know, go to a website, click through, do something. And I think you're right that you see a lot of bragging about what AI agents can do on X or whatever. And then most people go and try them and they don't accomplish the tasks that people are saying they can. So I think it's true that they're both overhyped, but also still at the same time, very useful that you have to find the right workflows to use LLMs where they actually do accelerate your work and then also not use them where they don't. If you just try to use them to replace parts of your work today, you'll faceplant and spend more time correcting its output than actually you would have taken you to do it. But if you use them really narrowly tailored for the parts of your work that you need them for, they can be really productive because some tedious tasks you can replace to an LLM to free you up to do more things. So it does require a lot of experimentation to find the right workflows that they are actually really speeding up for you and not try to just use them for everything and then just end up wasting way more time.
When you say tedious tasks, what comes to mind?
So the obviously biggest use of LLMs right now is software engineers using LLMs to write software. And so there's a lot of cases where you're writing really nitty gritty stuff that has to be exactly right or exactly the way you want it, where you can't use an LLM. It's just going to do it slightly off. It's going to be too, they've overtrained them now to try to only add new code and like touch as little of your existing code as possible because they used to touch too much existing code. And so now they've now like overcorrected and now they don't touch any existing code. And so it's very easy to use LLMs to just keep adding more and more and more, and your code becomes unwieldy and doesn't work anymore. And so you can't use them for that. But for some more tedious tasks, like, you know, changing a variable name that's referenced in a million places, well, okay, there's some automated refactoring logic. There's some existing software that can do that in an automated way. But things that are slightly less automatable, so something where, you know, there's a pattern you want to apply, but it's very fuzzy, and you could maybe come up with some automated rules to apply that pattern across your code base, but it's kind of hard and you spend more time coming up with the automated rules than doing it, but it's still going to take you an hour. But an LLM is really good at that, right? So there's some pattern you want to apply, it can just do it repeatedly. Also, sometimes writing certain tests, LLMs can be really good at writing a test that might otherwise be really annoying because you got to get everything exactly right, but the LLM can just spend a bunch of time doing it and you can go do something else. And it'll take it a while to do it and it might have to play around with it a bunch, but you don't have to do it. You can go do something else while it's doing it.
Why should we all care about AI agents?
I mean, because this is a huge productivity unlock for certain tasks, even today, right? And these models continue to get better, and so they'll be better at more and more tasks. But it's already the case that they're a huge productivity unlock for different classes of work today, and are going to change the way people interact with computers. They're going to change a lot of how people do many tasks, because now all of a sudden you just have to describe what you want done and it can go do it. Again, there's many things it can't do, but there are many things it can. And so people need to be engaging with this and trying it and figuring out what they can, you know, how much better they can be at whatever they're trying to accomplish by using these tools. These are great new tools, right? And so I think it's really important that people, you know, embrace the new tools and get that productivity unlock that they were going to get.
What's something that an AI agent can do today that people wouldn't believe?
Oof. Yeah, I mean, part of the problem is they can be pretty random. Like you can, because they are stochastic, they are random, like their output. If you ask them the same question a bunch of times, they will give you a different output each time. You can turn that off, but the performance is worse. Because they are random, very often you'll see people talk about, like, look, I got my agent to do this thing and it's really amazing. And it like wrote all this awesome code that is really surprising that it can write. And then you try it and it doesn't. But I think, you know, in general, there are many programming tasks today where agents are materially better than basically any human. And so it is really interesting, right, that they're very good at some things and they're very bad at other things, even within the domain of like programming, right? So if you're writing, you know, a lot of like academic stuff where you're writing like a simulation of some very specific like physics process or something, fairly small code, very delicate code, has to be very performant, whatever. It's generally not surprising at this point that agents are often better than some of the best humans at writing these kinds of things. You know, small contained algorithms that might need to be very performant. You know, maybe the AI agent has to spend some time trying different things and whatever, but it can often be way better than even the best humans. And so I think that's been very interesting to watch kind of as they've grown very good in certain directions and haven't grown as much in other directions.
What do you think of popular AI agents like Claude, Grok, or ChatGPT?
Yeah. So there's a distinction between the models themselves. So there's, you know, all of the companies you list make models. So there's, Grok is a model and Anthropic obviously makes the Claude models. And then there's separately, there's agents and agent harnesses, right? So something that uses the models to enable the model to do certain things. And so there's like Claude Code is a program that you run that, you know, accesses the Claude model and then it allows the Claude model to run commands on your computer. There's also Hermes and OpenClaw and whatever else. There's many of these and Goose and there's many of these agent software packages, right? So because this space has moved so fast, a lot of the existing agent software has also moved fast and some in some cases moved too fast. So example, the OpenClaw, I think, is the great example. It's now becoming a little less popular because it moved too fast, merged too many PRs that were written by AI that might not have always been the best quality. And so I think a lot of their user base has gotten frustrated with how often it doesn't work, how often it breaks and new updates break things and change things and whatever, versus some other agent software that is trying to take a different approach and has been maybe slower to build, but also doesn't break things as much and maybe has a more reliable user experience.
What are the best open source AI agents today, in your opinion?
On the agent software side, I'm partial to Goose because I work with that team regularly. So I like the Goose harness. Also, Permes is very popular and has a good harness if you want something that you can talk to through your existing chat interface. So if you want to text your agent over Signal or SMS or whatever, then mm-hmm. you can use Hermes for that. That's on the agent harness side, but on the model side, you know, obviously the best AI, the best LLM models that are open source that are available for people to run locally on their own hardware, assuming they can afford the hardware to run it, which is pretty hard these days.
How expensive is it?
Well, yeah, part of the problem is that the prices for hardware have just run up very quickly, right? Because of the AI boom, you know, OpenAI and Anthropic and Facebook and Google and everybody are buying the entire supply of all the memory that is made and all the chips that are made every year, and there's not much supply left for the rest of us. And so the prices for a lot of things like memory have 4x'd, 5x'd over the last year or so. And so that's gotten fairly expensive. But, you know, you can still get, if you're comfortable with a model output being relatively slow, you can still put together a computer that can run local AI very competitively for, you know, call it $5,000 or so. But all those models are the Chinese firms. So none of the Western firms, well, except for there's one based in France that I'm forgetting the name of now. But all of the, for the most part, all the competitive and especially all the really good open source models that you could run yourself or that, you know, someone else can run on your behalf that's not, you know, one of these labs that makes their own models are all from Chinese labs. So far the dynamic has been very interesting that it's been the West versus China, and China has been the one building the open source thing, and the West has been the one building the closed thing that you know, some company is trying to lock down for to make more money.
Venice by Eric Borchich
yeah.
is an open source one, right?
So yeah, Venice offers the open source models, right? So the closed source models are just these large firms, right? If you want the best model right now, you have to go pay Anthropic or OpenAI a lot of money for it. But if you are willing to use something that's you know, 90% as good, then you can save a lot of money by going to someone who is hosting it on AWS, or you could buy your own hardware and host it and use some of these Chinese models that have been trained. They're fairly expensive to train, but some of these large Chinese firms that have trained these models and released them as open source. You can use like Hermes or Goose or something as the software to install locally, and then you have to find a provider that offers models. And then you're paying someone, you know, however many cents per word coming in or out of out of the LLM. And yeah, there's many provider, OpenRouter and whatever that offer these models hosted for you. Now there's some really cool ones. There's some folks who, like Maple, for example, they will run these models on a cloud server, but the content you send to the server and the content coming from the server is encrypted in such a way that they can't see it. So you actually, as like proof of NVIDIA, basically, is what it is. So it's I can connect directly to the GPU running in their server, the NVIDIA GPU, and that GPU will tell me, like, hey, this is the software I'm running, and this is the model I have loaded, and whatever. And then I can verify that, and I can verify that is NVIDIA said that was real NVIDIA hardware, and that hasn't been tampered with, and I can be relatively confident that actually Maple, the service provider, can't see what I'm telling the LLM and what the LLM is telling me. So this is actually a really cool thing that some providers are starting to do to offer much more private LLMUs.
And how much does this cost monthly?
So yeah, it depends a lot on the model you use. And so, you know, some of the smaller models can fit in small GPUs, move very quickly. So specifically the LLM you use, so the specific software package that is running on the GPU, either in the cloud or locally, they can vary very substantially. So some of the smaller models, some of these smaller LLMs that are still very capable and you know, maybe 70% is good or whatever, can fit in a small GPU. They can fit in, you know, they have something on the order of like 30 billion parameters. So how many parameters they have, and then you know, those parameters can be different sizes, but you know, they have 30 billion. The large models, now we don't know for sure how large Anthropic's models are and OpenAI's models, but they're probably on the order of a trillion and a half parameters, right? And so the cost scales somewhat proportionally, somewhat more than proportionally with that parameter count, because it means how much can you fit on the GPU, how many clients can you service on the GPU, and how fast can that same GPU using the same amount of power spit out output for each client. And so if you have a small model, it can spit out that output very, very quickly, and you can get a lot more clients on there. You can, using the same GPU, same amount of power, same cost, you get a lot more output. Versus something that has, you know, 10x, 100x more parameters and takes up 10x or 100x space on the GPU, often takes up 3, 4, 5 times more time per token, has to read more memory. And so that means at least 3, 4, 5 times more cost for that, to use that LLM versus the other one that you might use. So it varies very substantially. And then on top of that, Anthropic and OpenAI and all these other large labs charge a lot of money on top of that because it's very expensive for them to train the model. And so they have to then bake that cost into the cost they're charging you, compared to, for example, some of the open source models where, yes, it was very expensive that this Chinese company trained the model, but now the model is open source and they're giving it away. And so anyone can then run that and sell it to you at a lower cost. So it varies really substantially, and you can get, you can do a bunch with $20 a month, or you can very easily spend $1,000 a month.
What China?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. So far, they have the LLMs that they've been building have at max been 90% as good at the same time, right? So the space is moving very quickly. The LLMs Chinese companies, you know, Alibaba and whatever, are releasing now are still much better than the LLM, the best LLMs 3 months ago. But, you know, at best, they've been like 90% as good. And so as a result, if they want people to use them, they either have to drastically underprice them or just open source them. And so, you know, a big part of it's just been this international dynamic of everyone wants to be win AI. They want, you know, the government, everybody from top down wants to be the one, the country to win AI and have the best AI and capture all that value from all these new tools that are really speeding up people's workflows. So I think China has taken this, a lot of Chinese firms and Chinese government presumably leaning on them as well, has taken the strategy of saying, look, we're not currently winning, but we can capture all the long tail. And so it is true that, you know, all of the LLM use that isn't buying directly from OpenAI and Anthropic and Google and, yeah, basically just them, is using Chinese models. So everybody else is using the Chinese models because they're the best freely available models. And yes, it's true. If you ask them about Tiananmen Square, they'll say, I don't know what you're talking about. And if you ask them about Taiwan, they'll say, no, it's a part of China. And so they do get some ability to kind of push their worldview through this. And that's probably some part of it. But I think the biggest part of it is just that they want to win AI. And as long as they're not quite as good, the best way to do that is to take these models, open source them, and get everyone using them so that everyone is using the Chinese AI, right? Rather than using OpenAI or Anthropic.
Is there a reason why I shouldn't or we shouldn't use Chinese open source agents?
Depends on what for. So it, they don't, certainly people watch what their agents do, and so they don't generally misbehave and just like steal all your data and send it to China or something like that. In some cases they could, but they don't appear to have been trained to do that. But also, yeah, for in cases where people are asking questions, you know, a lot of people these days use these chat interfaces to LLMs to ask questions and learn things, and students are using it to learn about the world and whatever. There are obviously some cases where you shouldn't be asking a Chinese LLM about, you know, the status of Taiwan and the history of China and some parts of the history of the Western world, because those LLMs are very clearly trained to tell you about things from a Chinese viewpoint.
We have the same with Claude or ChatGPT.
It's true. Everything ends up having some viewpoint, whether it's trained into it deliberately or not. Obviously, I think that the Anthropic and OpenAI and others are spending less time training models to say very specific things about history. But there are other cases where people have showed that, you know, the Western models are very unwilling to criticize Israel. They will refuse to criticize Israel. You can ask them explicitly, you know, criticize this country. Okay, criticize this country. Okay, criticize this country. Okay, criticize Israel. No, I can't do that. Right. So there's definitely the case that there are other worldviews that are being baked into those models. I think that's true, but I would think that there is less being baked into those models than the Chinese models. Yeah, I mean, probably to ask about certain political things, an LLM is not quite the right tool.
So if I go for a Chinese open source AI agent, which one would you recommend?
Yeah, so the best models right now are Qwen, which is made by Alibaba, and DeepSeek, if you have much larger GPUs, which is a former trading firm in Hong Kong. But so yeah, using those are the probably the two most popular groups of models for open source use. And then of course you'd then need the agent wrapper itself, so Goose or Hermes or something like that.
Can you explain why AI agents can't just use a credit card like we do?
Yeah, so it's a very good question. So the answer in short is they can, but the credit card system can't really support that. So, you know, it's true they can, and there are tools where, you know, you can tell your AI agent, here's my credit card number, and, you know, please go browse the web and buy this and whatever, and enter my credit card number. And people can do that and do that. The problem is Visa and MasterCard, their networks are not set up for this, right? So the entire credit card networks are set up for making a payment, and then if it happened to be fraud somehow or wrong or whatever, you can get your money back. How does this work? When I told, you know, this model, please go buy me, you know, this pair of shoes that has these specific properties or whatever, and it went and bought something else, who's liable for that? Am I liable for that? Is the merchant liable for that? Who gets the money? And there's not really, the Visa doesn't have a clear answer to this. Probably the answer is I get the money and the merchant gets screwed. And so merchants aren't willing to accept this. So we saw this with OpenAI. OpenAI actually did build somewhat this product, not exactly, but somewhat this product where you can choose to buy things within the chat interface. They had to roll it back because merchants refused to participate, because all the merchants today, the way they mitigate the risk of all these fraud issues is in part making sure that only a human can use their website. So all these CAPTCHAs and mouse tracking and whatever else to make it so that if a bot or an AI agent is the one using the website, they can detect that and then block the transaction. Obviously, their whole goal is to block AI agents. And so, yes, it can work sometimes, but writ large, like if it becomes popular, it would be too problematic for them, and they couldn't allow it. So we have seen Visa and MasterCard try to build out their own API for this specifically, which, you know, is kind of a pop-up out of the chat dialogue. So maybe you're telling ChatGPT or whatever, like, go buy me shoes, I want this pair of shoes, whatever, and it pops up and it says, you know, here's a website, I want to buy from it, here's the product image or whatever, please click approve or deny. And so that is what Visa and MasterCard want to do, and that's kind of fine if you just live in today's world and you don't think about the future. But if you actually are worried about, like, what are people going to want to do with these things? Well, what if I tell my agent to go start a startup to sell widgets or, you know, whatever? How does my AI agent then, you know, it has to go buy a domain, it has to go buy web hosting, it has to go, you know, maybe it has to do some research and buy access to certain research APIs to find out more information about the widgets I want to sell. All of a sudden, I'm getting like all these stupid pop-ups about like, hey, do you want to approve your agent buying this? I want to just tell it, here's your $5. Go like, you know, spend your $5 wildly. I don't care, right? And so this concept of how Visa and MasterCard are structured around liability for the merchant when the merchant doesn't perform and the consumer can do this chargeback thing just doesn't work in this new world. Right. And so there has to be something new. And so it's really right now, it seems like the something new is either going to be Bitcoin or stablecoins.
How are companies like Stripe, OpenAI, Google, Coinbase, and Visa trying to implement AI payments?
Yeah. So there's currently Cambrian explosion of different approaches. But for the most part, with the exception of Visa, everybody is kind of pulling in this direction of a new payment rail. So either stablecoins or, you know, maybe it's direct settlement. Maybe it's like, you know, OpenAI, a bunch of OpenAI users buy a bunch of products and then OpenAI sends the merchant a wire or something. I don't know. But so there's been, you know, everybody's got their own protocol for it. Weirdly, I think in this case, it doesn't actually matter, because if there's one thing an LLM is really good at, you know, all these LLMs are really good at writing short snippets of code. And so if the, you know, the website says like, to access this website, you have to use this specific API in this specific way, the LLM has no problem with that. It's just going to write that code to do that, and then it can happily do that. So I don't think that really matters. What really matters is the payment rail, like the LLM, you know, your local AI agent tool has to be able to have access to the right payment rail that the merchant wants. And so, you know, there has to be this kind of somehow agreement on what payment rails people are going to use. And so far, it has mostly been stablecoins is what people are mostly pushing. And of course, they want that. These companies pushing these things want the stablecoin that they own to win. Because if everyone in the world is transacting with USDC, well, then Circle makes a ton of money because everybody has to have float in USDC that adds up to a lot of money and a lot of interest for them. So everybody wants to win this game. And so far it's been mostly stablecoins the way people are pushing. But I think Bitcoin has a real shot here as a dark horse where we're the open alternative. Instead of everybody fighting over who gets to be the stablecoin that wins, Bitcoin might actually have a chance at saying like, no, we're open and you can just use it.
If AI agents start buying through platforms like Amazon, won't those platforms end up deciding the future payment system?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very real possibility, is that some of the largest merchants get to decide what payment rails people use because they can set what they need to be paid in. So far, we largely haven't seen merchants engage very much on this. You know, we've seen a lot of payment processors like Stripe, you know, payments people in the payments industry, which is mostly payment processors, try to push their stablecoin or whatever. But yeah, I think they don't have the power. It's you're totally right. It's the merchants. It's Amazon. It's Walmart. It's these large merchants who can decide. So Amazon has invested in some of these AI companies. That's true, but for the most part, I don't think they haven't yet engaged much on the AI agent payment side. They've mostly invested because of their AWS business, where they're powering a lot of the AI training and AI inference workloads out of their GPUs in the AWS business. But yeah, they haven't really engaged very much. And OpenAI too has, you know, they've done these partnerships, but they're not really pushing, you know, we're going to pick USDC on base or whatever yet. So I think there's, to some extent, we have this shot. If we can push small merchants and small agent providers, so people like I mentioned Maple earlier, but maybe get it into Goose or OpenClaw or Hermes, where Bitcoin becomes the default option that's always available, then if we can get the client side and maybe a few merchants, smaller merchants and whatever, then maybe like Amazon doesn't care. Amazon just wants your money. Like if the thing that all the agents support is Bitcoin, Amazon will just say, all right, screw it. We'll take Bitcoin from the agents. We don't care. That's not our problem. Versus I think if we do nothing or if we don't win, then the answer will just be that Amazon will pay Circle a ton of money in interest and take USDC.
What does the world look like if one or a few big companies control the AI agents, the data, and the payment systems?
Yeah, no, it's not great. And I think that's to some extent the way it's trending. And I think we should all be pushing back against OpenAI and Anthropic and even XAI and all these guys who just want to be the ones to control the models. They want to be the ones to have the only good models that no one else should. Open source models should be bad, and only their proprietary models should be used. And then once they do that, then they have control over how you interact with the model. Presumably, they'll run their own agent services that everyone will use those, and not be able to use open source local agents. And then also, as a result of that, get to pick the payment rails and everything else. And I think it's definitely a very major concern right now. Is that these large companies are moving towards trying to own this, I mean, in their view, AGI in the entire future. I don't think that's necessarily the trend it's on, but own a huge part of the economy and a tool that powers a lot of parts of the economy. And then also, yeah, I mean, like people's data. Like already today, a ton of people are constantly asking LLMs about health questions, about personal questions, relationship questions, and all of that going in one big honeypot to Anthropic and OpenAI is crazy. That is frightening for humanity, even just if it gets hacked or internal, like, you know, internal support people leak information. It's really frightening how the implications that might have in the future. Yeah, I'm worried about it. It is very expensive to train these models. I'm not in a position to do very much about that, but it is very concerning.
In 2022, PayPal proposed fining people $2,500 for spreading misinformation. They walked it back, but the idea was there. Are we sleepwalking into a terrifying new control system?
Yes. Yes. I mean, I don't know how else to put that, but like, yes, I think there's a very real shot that, you know, AI becomes this huge tool for control. A lot of people aren't searching for information themselves anymore. They're not using Google. They're not using Bing or whatever, or even searching on X for recent posts about it, or searching on Reddit or whatever. They're just going and asking an LLM, and whatever the LLM tells them, they assume it's true, which A, isn't how LLMs work. You can't assume what they tell you is true. But also, yeah, these companies could change how they respond. And they are. I mean, it is true that the Chinese models will, if you ask them about things that are politically sensitive in China, they'll give you the politically correct response for China. If you ask the Western models about politically sensitive things, like, for example, Israel and criticize Israel, they'll give you the politically correct answer for the West. And the amount of control that has over shaping people's views is frightening. And the idea that, you know, only a few companies are going to have access to this and only a few companies are going to decide all these decisions on how these things get trained and what information they have and therein influence hundreds of millions and billions of people's view is crazy. That is a huge risk, like something we should all be very worried about and all be speaking out about. But also it costs billions of dollars to train these models. So I can't do anything about it. There's not that much I can do about it.
Spread the word.
Yeah.
What needs to be built right now to stop that from happening?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a question of, and we are seeing some of this be built. It's this question of having more competition. The good thing is some these open source models are 90% as good, right? And that you can use them for most of the same things you could use any of the proprietary models for. And yes, they're Chinese and they have certain Chinese views, but it's also open source. You can retrain them. You can actually go back and change how the model responds to certain questions. And that's way cheaper than training a new model. Like you can do that at home. I mean, okay, with maybe a $10,000 or $20,000 GPU, but you can do that at home. Like that's possible. And people do that. So, you know, making people aware of this issue, and then also just having more competition and more chat interfaces and more different ways that people interact with these things, so that there's more, hopefully, just more competition, really, I think is the big one.
About Lightning, can an AI agent use Lightning today?
Yeah, absolutely. No, there's a few wallets dedicated to AI agents specifically. So like Money Dev Kit is one. I think there's a PhoenixD wrapper or skill file that tells an agent how to interact with PhoenixD. There's also Lexi, I think, has a agent wallet, and Albi. So there's a few Bitcoin companies trying to compete in this and trying to really enable AI agents to use Lightning. There's different models. It's still early. You know, do you give your agent its own wallet? How much money do you put in it? Do you, you know, make it so that you have to sign off on all the transactions? Is that too burdensome? So there's a lot of things to figure out and a lot of experimentation to have to be done here. But yes, there are several projects that you can use to go give your AI agent a wallet.
If AI agents start using Lightning at scale, what part of the network struggles first? And can Arc or eCash be part of the solution?
Yeah, I mean, so into the second question is yes. There's not much different about an AI agent from a human in terms of what they can use in terms of Bitcoin wallets. They're maybe a little more forgiving on the UX front. They're a little more willing to deal with something that's frustrating to use because they have a lot more patience than humans do. But yeah, I mean, I think at scale, like at huge scale, you know, we would probably be okay just because most people at the end of the day will use a centralized, they're not going to run their own agent software locally, they're going to use something hosted for them by someone, and that something hosted for them can also just provide custodial Bitcoin services. And so, like, you know, if you're going to use a hosted agent, you can also just use their hosted wallet. But yeah, I mean, if we actually had millions and millions and tens of millions and hundreds of millions of people trying to onboard their AI agents to Lightning wallets self-custodially all at once, then yeah, we would probably need something like Arc to enable more Lightning channels to be opened that don't require all the on-chain space.
What can Bitcoin do that Visa or banks can't? And is it ready for it?
I think it's the credible neutrality part. Like it is not controlled by someone, and you can trust it. Like you can have your own and it is yours. And I do think that is compelling to a lot of people. But frankly, the most compelling thing, like the reason people might actually use Bitcoin for this, is just that banks, like these large companies, are slow to change. It is so entrenched. Like Visa is not a company, right? Visa is a co-op between many large banks. And so in order to say, oh, this like merchant liability thing that we've been doing doesn't scale to AI agents, we need to change the liability structure of the Visa network, Visa can't just do that. Visa has to get the member banks to actually want to do that and make that the new reality. They could, in theory, I think there's actually some legal issues in the United States, but they could pay off enough senators to get that law changed. But they won't. In order to convince all of these large legacy institutions to change on a dime and fundamentally change a core part of their payment rail, all of a sudden, is just not going to happen. And so that's why you see people instead choose to focus on stablecoins for AI agentic payments. And hopefully that's also where, this Bitcoin provides the same set of values. And then hopefully Bitcoin has a shot there and that people start building towards it.
And you think Bitcoin is ready for it?
Yeah, I think it is. Again, in part because if it does scale to that size, most people are going to be using centralized things, and those centralized things can just offer custodial balances and wouldn't offer Bitcoin balances, right? Like, most people don't want a Bitcoin balance, they want a dollar balance. And then their service provider will just buy some Bitcoin and pay the merchant, and that's it. And it'll pull from your dollar balance, right? So that would work totally fine today, right? That Lightning can scale very substantially with a small handful of very, very large custodial services running large nodes.
And is that what we want?
We want people to have the option to pick who they trust, because that's not really something you can do today with the traditional finance rails. The reality is most people are not going to self-custody. My job is to reduce the UX difference between self-custody and custodial as much as possible so that as many people select to do self-custody as possible. But we're never going to get better. Like, a centralized system is always going to be more efficient than the decentralized one and then the self-custodial one. And so people will use those custodial systems, and that's fine. And like, it's fine that many people do that. And like, my job is to make it so that fewer people do that and more people do self-custody. But the reality is simply that most people would just onboard to something that's custodial, and they'll pick who they trust, and they'll only use something they trust, and that's still much better than the existing system. So,
could AI agents be what finally bring Bitcoin to the masses?
It's possible. I think it's a long shot, but I do think we really do have a shot here. Like, that if we really push on this, and enough AI agent tooling integrates Bitcoin natively, and then people start actually using it and talking to merchants and getting online merchants especially to start offering Bitcoin as payment rails, then again, it just snowballs, right? It becomes the default, and it snowballs very quickly. And it's a long shot because Coinbase and Circle and PayPal and whoever else are all trying to push their stablecoins and put a lot of money behind their stablecoins to be the winner here. But maybe not. Like, the game is wide open. Bitcoin has never had an opportunity like this, because Bitcoin has always been the underdog against traditional finance that has infinitely more resources and is the entrenched player. Right now, there is no entrenched player in agentic payments because it's too early. It barely exists yet. So it's still anyone's game. Anyone could become the entrenched player, and Bitcoin has a shot there. Again, it's a long shot, but I think we have to try, because we've never had an opportunity like this. This is crazy.
But here is the thing. If every coffee purchase triggers a tax event, how can Bitcoin succeed as practical everyday money?
Yep. I think that's definitely a big concern. It's something that blocks lobbyists have spent a lot of time trying to get Congress to fix. But yeah, I mean, I think that's a big concern. To some extent, the law has to change, because it just doesn't, if AI agents start doing this, how does it work? Like, who pays the tax? Like, even ignoring Bitcoin for a moment, if AI agents start, sports betting, like they go start making sports bets using Bitcoin or maybe using stablecoins, how does that tax work? They're not an entity. They're not a person. In many cases, they're not anything. Like, they might not have a company. It might have been spawned by a person, but maybe it's off doing its own thing. It owes taxes. But how does that work? So, there's a lot here that's just going to need to get figured out. And I think it's not worth getting too hung up over it yet. But also, yeah, I mean, we should, to the greatest extent possible, we need to fight to get that law changed.
And can Bitcoin win in a world where governments push stable coins and CBDCs they can't control and censor?
Yeah, I think that's a good point too, that the governments are going to try to push something they prefer. I keep coming back to, like, defaults are so sticky that it is so hard to break an entrenched monopoly that everyone uses. Everyone uses Visa, everyone uses MasterCard. It is so hard to get anyone to care about anything else. And it's great that Bitcoin is cheaper in the United States, at least, than Visa and MasterCard for merchants, and that merchants might want to use Bitcoin. But it's just so hard to break that entrenched monopoly on a two-sided market where both buyers and sellers have to have the same payment rail. And so, yeah, I don't know that all the pressure of governments would be enough to break that entrenched monopoly, assuming we were to win?
Because it's in their interest to put more and more regulations on Bitcoin in order to push CBDCs.
And it would slow it down. But if we got to the point where people are using open agents and making merchant payments, and all of a sudden that workflow stops working because governments have added some new regulation on it, and all of a sudden your agent has to KYC the human that started it in order to make a payment, people would just complain. Like the one good thing about democracy is that it is still the case that even in the US or wherever else, and most democracies, if a huge volume of people complain, they will fix, they will undo it. And so there is still a check there that would prevent totally wrecking it if it were to become the dominant player.
In your article, Bitcoin has a golden opportunity with AI agents. You argue that Bitcoiners need to start using Lightning and AI agents with wallets so merchants begin paying attention. How do we do that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, to a large extent right now, it's reaching out to merchants. It's talking to merchants and saying, hey, I want to buy your widgets. Why aren't you taking Bitcoin? Like, I want my agent to buy. Like, I need to buy your widgets once a month. Maybe it's my subscription service to a stake, Good Farm. Maybe it's whatever it is. I want you to enable Bitcoin payments so that my agent can just do this for me. So it's right now it's just reaching out to merchants and talking to them and saying, look, I want to do this thing. You'll save 2%, 3% on Visa fees. I will get my agent to be able to do this, and I don't have to try to use Visa, which doesn't really work for this. So I think that's the big step right now is just, trying these things, getting comfortable with them, using agents, seeing what you can do with them, and then reaching out to merchants and just saying like, hey, I want to use your service and buy from you, but I need you to take Bitcoin for it.
What projects are already being built around this?
Sadly, we haven't gotten default integration into AI agent software yet for Bitcoin wallets, but it is... one of the good things about LLMs is they're pretty good at you tell them, I say, here's some context, and you set the context of like, well, you have a local Bitcoin wallet, here's how you access it. They're good at just doing that, and then they can take advantage of that. So I mentioned a few earlier, is like Money Dev Kit and Albi and Lexi and PhoenixD, I think all have options for giving your agent a wallet. And I think that's basically the only thing that needs to be built is just agents to have wallets, but then we just need people to use it. So for the most part, stuff has been built. There's still a lot to be figured out there and having the right UX and getting it better and whatever. But for the most part, it's just people need to use it. People need to tell merchants they want to use it.
What do you think developers are underestimating?
I think I often, and some developers often, underestimate how long it takes people to change. So you see this a lot in the software engineering world right now around AI is, software engineers have adopted LLMs very substantially in their work. Surveys and large companies and software engineers are using LLMs drastically, and companies are pushing that on their employees. But in many cases, their employees are just using them because, these are great tools that can help you do a lot of your work much more effectively. But I think then people extrapolate that onto the world and assume that everyone in the world is using LLMs a lot for their work. And I don't think that's true at all, that there's, for the most part, people have adopted LLMs as a chat interface, as a replacement for Google in many cases, but not actually using agents that can do tasks on their behalf. And I think that is going to take a while to get traction. And so all these companies like rushing to do agentic payments, I think are getting a little ahead of themselves. But at the same time, at some point that adoption will kind of flip over, like it'll get over the hump, and then all of a sudden it'll be adopted very quickly once people start to realize this and share with their friends what they're doing and whatever. And so I think we want to get ahead of that as much as possible, just like everybody else is trying to get ahead of that. But we want to also try to compete and get out ahead of that before it happens.
If you had to guess, who wins this race?
Yeah, stablecoins. If I had to guess, it's probably going to be stablecoins. I don't know which one. Because of regulatory changes in the United States, it's now much easier for a company to issue a stablecoin. And so I don't actually know that USDC is necessarily going to win. It might be PayPal USD, or it might be some, maybe the banks start issuing stablecoins. I know some of them are looking at that. So I don't know which stablecoin, but if I had to guess, stablecoins are going to win. That doesn't mean we don't have a shot at this, but they have a better shot. They have more money to spend on doing it.
Do you think people are ready for this shift?
Yes and no. Like, people aren't thinking about it. People aren't aware of it. People aren't doing it. But at the same time, once people start to do something, it becomes very natural, right? So like, you look at software engineering, I look at my work, whereas like, you know, up until the end of last year, LLMs weren't really good enough at coding for them to be like all that useful for my work. You know, they were useful for some small stuff here and there, but not very much. And then all of a sudden they kind of reached this point where they were fairly useful. And then all of a sudden, a lot of software engineers who had not been adopting them or been adopting them very loosely, all of a sudden all adopted them very quickly, right in succession, because people talk to each other and talk about how much more capable these models suddenly were. Not that they were like, you know, 10x more capable, but that they had finally reached some threshold where they were a lot more capable. And so I think like once it becomes the default, it'll just be very natural. It'll feel very natural to people, and people will be like, how did we not do this before? But at the same time, right now, today, people can't quite model like, oh, we're just going to like chat with an agent that's going to buy us stuff. People are like, oh, that's weird. I can just buy stuff on Amazon. Why do I care?
In fixing payments for AI agents, what door are we opening? What are the unintended consequences?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of risk to the future of AI. Like you asked earlier about centralization concerns around these large companies controlling AI. And I think that's probably one of the most obvious potential consequences here, is that people end up using one or two providers. You know, maybe Google wins, maybe OpenAI wins, whatever, and that's the way everyone buys everything now. And again, now this company has a lot more control than they already had, or just a lot of control over, you know, large parts of the economy, in addition to what people think and whatever. So a lot of data, a lot of control over like, oh, well, you know, you told it to buy a pair of shoes with these properties. Well, it could pick that one or that one, and it's going to always pick that one because they paid for the ad space or whatever, you know. So there's a lot of potential control that these companies might gain as a result of this, that I think is very concerning. I think that's the most obvious one right now, just because it's already starting to play out that way. You know, it's hard to see the future. This stuff is moving so fast, and because it is very different in the type of tool that it is versus what humanity has had in the past, it is kind of hard to predict exactly how it's going to play out. But that's the obvious one that comes to mind, because it's kind of already happening.
And last one, if someone listening thinks this sounds big, but what can I do? What's your answer?
Yeah, I mean, again, this like the future, how this is going to be decided is going to be in small starts, right? It's going to be a few merchants accepting these and people using it and people buying from them using Bitcoin, and then a few more merchants and then a few more merchants. And it can snowball very, very quickly. Once you get a few merchants who talk to each other and then talk to their friends, it can snowball very quickly. So it's really just about getting that momentum going. So getting online merchants taking Bitcoin for things people want to buy and want to buy regularly, especially, and starting to let that grow, let a lot of people starting to use agents, give them a Bitcoin wallet, play with it, give feedback to developers so that people can improve the user experience of those wallets and how that stuff works. And then just actually buying for merchants using Bitcoin, and especially online, and using AI agents and giving merchants website feedback on, you know, you have to make your website more agent friendly. You have to do X or Y or whatever. And so I think it's just starting, because the earlier we start, the better the tooling we can have. You know, the more feedback developers and merchants can get on the tooling so that we can have the best possible foot forward once that race starts in earnest. And then hopefully we'll have enough of a critical mass that it can start to grow and really snowball from there. So I think it really is, this is going to start very small, and the really small steps can have a really huge impact.
Matt, thank you for your time and this generous conversation. Where can people find you and your work?
Thanks. This has been really fun. People can find me for the most part on X, the Blue Matt on X. And then I have a blog that's linked from there, and then you can follow some of my work from there.
Are you a Nostr?
Yes, I have a Nostr account. How do I share my Nostr? I mean, I have an NPub. I can read my full NPub.
We will put it on the show notes.
Click the link in the show notes to find my find my NPub.
It's been a pleasure having you on. I can't wait to have you back. Until then, stay sovereign.
Yeah, it's been great. Thanks.